Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 13, delivered on October 1.
Today, interest rates. Before I get down to the subject material, we'll look at the numbers. I'll also mention to you that your exam is next week on Thursday. Now, on Tuesday, I will be spending the entire class period reviewing. Now, I will go through, I'll tell you what I expect of you, and that will take about 20 minutes. I'll even have the exam in front of me, and I'll be reading, thinking about what I need you to know. Now, after 20 minutes, it's going to be your call. I'm going to say, do you have any questions for me? If you all stay quiet, that's the end of the class. If you decide that you actually want to do well on the exam, you start asking questions. Like, for example, you could say, well, is this going to be on the test? And I would say, if it's not, I'm going to say, no, don't worry about that. Don't study that. You can ask me about anything related to the test. And that's your call, how long you want to ask questions of me. But you should be prepared for questions so that you can get the best possible score on this exam. Also, no, I don't give study guides because life is not going to give you a study guide. You're getting ready to graduate, may God help us, in the next year and a half or so. So I'm trying to get you ready for what's facing you out there in the corporate world, where you're told information, and then you are expected to know that after you're told once. To that extent, though, I do allow you to have a 6x4 note card for the exams, okay, front and back. So that's worth it. The exam is lecture-based. If it's in the book too, great. But if I haven't said it in class, it's not part of your exam. So your best bet is to study your notes, sit down with my podcasts, and have your notes open in front of you. You will be amazed at how much is not in your notes that I said. Get yourself ready and stay frosty. It's 40 questions, mostly multiple choice, some true and false. Just stay frosty, and you'll do fine. And if you don't, we also have a trucking school over at Heartland Community College. Well, that was insensitive. Okay, fine. One way or the other, though. Truth be told, you're going to the score on the first exam is probably in the 65% average range. You get better. You learn how to do these kinds of tests, and you do very well on the final exam. So this first test is your shock experience with actually being expected to show me that you learned what I told you to learn in class. And again, you be prepared to ask me a lot of questions. I'll have the exam right here in front of me, and I'll, you know, just, okay, I see, then I'll talk to you, well, you should know this and that. One time I actually had the exam on the overhead projector, which was on. I didn't know it. I thought, damn, these people are writing fast. And, oh. I won't make that mistake again. So anyway, difficult. And of course, I have my office hours. You can come in there and hang out with everyone else and get yourself ready for it. But a quick look at the numbers here. Oh, you get that formula, yeah, that formula sheet, what was it called? Your financial ratios formulas sheet. You get to have that with you, too. Don't write anything on that. My TA will eat your head off if she sees writing on that. But other than that, you've got a 4x6 note card that should put on there. Truth be told, you're probably not going to use it a lot during the exam. I do this because it's a great way to focus your studying. You're creating your own study guide by creating that note card, and it will help you. And don't write so small that you can't read it. I've had students, can you see what I wrote there? No, I can't. And I've also noticed, have you ever seen those people who can write in micro print? Anyway, was this a good or a bad day in the markets, madam?
I don't know.
You don't know? Tell me why you don't know. Haven't you ever heard of a black day in the markets? No, actually, this was one of those days that was just an absolute death-defying. It wasn't horribly down. We didn't have a crash, but it was definitely another negative day. We're accumulating them. This morning, the markets were all happy and all of that. Have you ever had one of those mornings where everything was looking great for you? You wake up, you feel good, you hear the Rocky music, bah, 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 and you go out and you stop by the mirror, oh, hey, if it's good enough for the ladies, it's good enough for me. And, you know, you walk out the door, and then you face, you know, something like Satan himself says, I'm going to send you to hell. Or, you know, you get hit by a car and dragged 300 feet. That was today. Everyone was happy. It was an up day until the manufacturing index was released for last month, which was the worst performance in 10 years. And so that bluebird of happiness, as you see there in that rise at the early morning, became a vulture of death. You had first a little bit of a surge because there was some sentiment that the index was going to come out good, expectation. And then when it came out, you had a bear surge, and it went off a cliff. And then it just bounced down, roller coaster, and by the end, we were down. It was a bad day. It was a strongly bad day. Does that mean that we're on the verge of a crash? I don't think so. I suspect that the markets are going to not have a day so hard down that it pops the circuit breakers. They're just going to bleed it down. There'll be up days. Don't get me wrong about that. But we're sitting in that dark zone at the beginning of a downturn of a correction in the market. And ultimately, probably next spring, a recession will begin, and it will be a hard recession. And so if you're looking for a job, I've said this before, an internship, get it now before things get a lot uglier. The discussions about politics being part of this crash, don't buy it. Politics is politics. It's probably not anything to do with the current work toward an impeachment of the president. It does have something to do with the trade problems that we're having and other things, but mostly it's just we're sliding into a recession and we can't stop it. No matter how much the White House screams at the Fed, lower interest rates, get the economy going again, that's wishful thinking. There's only so much adrenaline you can pump into a dead body and make it twitch. So keep that in mind. And again, we had another one of those disturbing days where the volume for the day was, in this case, about half of the average volume in the market. That is an indication that the heavies are staying off the playing field. A lot of this was client trade activity, and the big dogs themselves for their house accounts and for their rich people accounts and all that. This is wait and see. Stay away from investments right now. The other part of it, and I keep doing these, and I would expect that this might be something for the exam as well. As you can see, the investors were selling their equities. S&P 500, Dow, NASDAQ, Russell 2000, all down. That means that they're selling. Well, where are they putting the money? Well, if it's a first stage flight to quality, they'll put it into bonds, flight to safety. And so we look at the bond index and we say, oh, they were bailing out of bonds too. So we're in a stage two. Where would they put the money from bonds? Where's the next step, madam? Where's the next step? Gold. So let's see if gold was surging today. Well, spank me, sure was. Look at that, gold and silver both up nicely. That's a stage two flight to quality. Getting out of stocks, getting out of bonds, and moving to the safety of metals, hard objects. So this gives us an indication that there are definitely some issues that are going on in the markets right now. Notice, however, that the Nikkei was doing pretty good today. In other words, foreign investments, moving money, foreigners moving their money into foreign stock markets, even our investors moving over there. There's where we sit today. Although the FTSE, the Financial Times, did slide too. And a lot of that's the concerns about the risks and the uncertainty that are created by the current war over Brexit and all of that. But this is where we sit now. Highly volatile, risky market. The topic of today's lecture is interest rates. But the problem is that there are many different interest rates. Just to lay one out for it. Sir, what would be an interest rate? Where would you see an interest rate? On what? Well, be specific. There are a lot of different kinds of loans. Home mortgage. You'll get an interest rate on a mortgage, home mortgage. Another one, what would be another one, sir? Yeah, car loan. I mean, that would not be the same interest rate. Well, it might be, but that would be coincidental. They wouldn't be the same interest rate. Then you have other interest rates, like the interest rate on your credit card, the interest rate you would have on a short-term loan from a bank. You would have all kinds of different. There are interest rates on CDs. There are interest rates on CDs 1 month, 1 year, 3 year. There are different interest rates on different types of bonds and all that kind of stuff. Okay, first things first, is that there are actually a number of terms that mean an interest rate of one kind or another. There is an interest rate, you'll hear the interest rate. You might hear yield. You might hear coupon, if it's a bond. You might hear APR, annual percentage rate. You can hear a lot of different words that are essentially just interest rate of one kind or another. Now, an interest rate is actually a rental rate, okay? An interest rate is a rental rate on money or capital. You, sir, rent yourself out, okay? You do, you know. You know what we call that one? It's called the wage rate. That's your rental rate. They're not buying, that's not your price. I mean, I say, how much are you, big boy? I'm not asking to buy you. I can't afford you. You are very high maintenance. But I could rent you to do my lawn. Okay? Will you shut up, okay? I'm trying to keep a straight face and you're laughing over there. Okay, but you understand that's a rate too. There is a growth rate. There are decay rates. There are acceleration rates. There are diffusion rates. They are all actually just different examples of physics processes. Of one kind or another. Some of them have a physical part to them, like a diffusion rate of a gas through a different medium. There are some of them that are purely not physical, like an acceleration rate or something like that. Growth rates, generally, we would talk about some that are physical, like the growth rate of a population. There are some that are not physical at all, like the growth rate of an investment. But they all have this rate in them. And in finance, those rates are always a rental rate. Now, there is a price. Sometimes we have prices. But a lot of times, what we think of as a price is actually just a rental rate. And so just kind of keep that in mind as we go along here. But interest rates are different for different things. For a credit card, the interest rate is high. For a car loan, it's kind of not too terrible. For a home loan, it might be actually pretty low. The coupon rate on a high-quality AAA corporate bond is fairly modest these days, but the coupon rate for a junk bond would be probably a pretty high number, pretty big number. Like, for example, you might see a coupon rate on a AAA corporate bond at 3%. But if you saw a triple B bond, you might see a coupon rate that is closer to 5% or 6%. So first thing is to get all of this down. What is the structure of an interest rate? It has different pieces to it. An interest rate has two big pieces, two chunks, and then inside of those chunks are things. But the two big pieces are the risk-free rate, and the second big piece is the risk premium. Now, oddly, the risk premium is directly measurable. We can actually measure it. The risk-free rate is actually a theoretical object that we can only estimate by what we call proxies. The best proxy that we usually have is the interest rate, the yield, on a very short-term treasury. So oftentimes if someone says, well, what's a risk-free rate? I would go and look at the annualized rate on a three-month T-bill and say, this is approximately it. We call those kinds of things, we call that a proxy. It stands in the stead of the theoretical thing that we couldn't see. So, for example, in astrophysics, we cannot see a black hole, but we have proxies that tell us what its size is, where it is, what its size is, what its spin is, if it has an electrical charge, and all of that. So we can't see it directly, but we can see things that tell us everything we need to know about it. That's true about the risk-free rate. We can't see it, but we do have things that tell us what we need to know pretty much about it. Now, inside of the risk-free rate are two pieces. And neither of these, of course, we can measure directly, but we can know what they are to a decent extent by some statistical, well, probabilistic methods. The first piece of the risk-free rate is what we call the real rate of return. This is nothing but the equilibrium of the supply and demand for money. You probably remember, well, I don't know if you remember, in your economics class, Econ 101, you had a demand curve, and then, well, you have a supply curve, and where those come together. Where the quantity supplied is the same as it clears the market of the quantity demanded clears the market of the quantity supplied, and you have your equilibrium price. That was micro. In macro, I hope they showed you the same thing applies with money. We could have the amount of money here and the real rate here. And then there's a demand for money curve. And in your economics, they usually assume that the supply curve for money is perfectly inelastic. And there's your Uncle Bob. the equilibrium at any given time. If the Fed pushes money into the market, which our president is howling at the Fed to do, lower interest rates, that would mean that what would be happening is that the Fed would have to increase the money supply to bring the rate down from here to here. That's all it would mean. Just supply and demand. And it's real, too. I mean, the Fed has been for a long time printing money to try to keep interest rates low, because that last recession we had, 2008-2009, was a hell of a recession. It was, in fact, it was called the Great Recession. It's the worst one we'd had since the Great Depression, caused by policies of the White House, the Fed, and the legislature in the years from 2001 to 2007. And so the Fed just cranked up the money engine, printed money hand over fist, and it's been doing a lot of it since then to keep interest rates low. And it's worked until now, when the markets are saying enough. And if we keep printing money, we're going to create something terrible. We will create the same situation we had that was building up through the late 60s to the end of the 1970s. And in the lecture on Thursday, I will go through that story for you. You need to take really good notes for that one. But anyway, the real rate of return is just basically the equilibrium of supply and demand for money. That's all. And the other part is the expected inflation premium, which we designate by a pi with a little superscript e. This is not inflation. This is expected inflation. There is a big difference. And I can pretty easily show you that difference. You see, expected inflation is nasty. Expected inflation, if it starts accelerating, it embeds itself, and then it festers there. And you can bring down the actual inflation rate, but if the expectation is still there, then you have a problem that takes severe measures, as happened at the end of the 1970s. And it can make a recession into an awful thing, trying to fix an embedded expectation of inflation. But let me explain to you expected inflation. Because markets do not really actually, markets don't care about inflation. At the end of the day, what they care about is the expected inflation. Give you an example of this. Sir, I've decided to hire you as my trusted employee. You're going to work hard 40 hours a week, maybe sometimes more than that, but I'm going to pay you well. I'm going to start you out at $100 a week. Good times, am I right? $100? So, the first year comes your annual review. You come into my office and I say, well, you've been doing a great job. And so, by heaven, I want to keep you on my payroll. So, I said, well, the inflation rate last year was 2%. CPI for last year just came out. So I'm going to give you a 2% increase in your pay. Now, get back to work. Okay, next year comes by. The inflation, I say, well, I see that inflation last year was running at 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% increase. I'm a great employer. Love you to death. Get back to work. Well, the next year comes, and I say, well, I see this year inflation, last year inflation rose 6%, so I shall give you a 6% increase in your wages. And so the next year comes, and I start saying, well, I see that inflation this past year was 8%. And before I can open my mouth, you say, stop right there, fat boy. You've been robbing me. Why? No, well, actually, no, you're not. You are not making it. Not adjusted for inflation. You see, inflation ran at 2% that year, and at the end of the year, I gave you 2%. Do you understand that you had already lost the purchasing power over that entire year before you got the 2% raise? I didn't back that 2% up to the beginning of the year. I'm going forward at 2%. And then the next year, inflation ate 4% of your purchasing power. And then after it had done that, then I give you 4%. And then inflation ate 6% more of your purchasing power the next year. And then I give you 6%. So at this time, I'm opening my pie hole to say 8%. What do you say to me? No, no, say it. Give me a number. Oh, concentrate. 2, 4, 6, 8. Yes, 10. God, I don't have any capitalists in here. Whatever happened to greed? You almost made me cough up my tumor. Okay. Okay, do you understand? It's expectations that are what matters. It's not the average, it's not the last, it is the next that is all that matters. In financial markets, we're not stupid. We don't base an interest rate on what inflation has already done. We need to know what it is going to do to the purchasing power of the loan we make. If I lend you $1,000, I need to know how much it's going to erode before you pay off that loan. So I have to pop the interest rate with an expectation of inflation forward, not inflation already happened, you see. And that's the way unions deal. That's the way companies deal. We price based upon what we expect over the time period to come, because the past is dead. It is gone. It's with Jesus. It is not here on this earth anymore, or it's down with Satan, if it's money that was generated by evil capitalists. But you see, that's why that expected inflation. And it came to life. And there was a period of time after the 1970s, late 70s, when I was able to give lectures where there were a lot of students who, because of what had happened, the expectation of inflation had gotten so embedded in pricing, in wage negotiations, that even when we finally did clamp down and crush the money supply, no one believed us. Banks still were putting massive inflation premiums in their loans. Unions were still putting massive forward inflation rates into their wage negotiations, well, with the big auto companies and other companies. This is the evil one, is this expected inflation. And that's where we're headed. We are just keep printing money and printing money. Well, inflation is low. Yes, historical low. But once it starts creeping in, the understanding of the liquidity overhang we are creating with all this money we're shoveling in to try to save politicians, well, then things will get bad again. Okay. So now we've got that on the table. So here we have this risk premium. The risk premium has three parts to it. Now, every interest rate will have one or more of these in some greater or lesser amount. The first one is an extra amount of interest that is charged for the possibility that the borrower won't pay off the loan. We call it the default premium, R sub D. It is the reward for bearing risk. It is the reward for bearing risk that part or all of the loan will not be paid. It is a reward for bearing risk that part or all of the loan will not be repaid. So now, let's talk about this default premium. A treasury security would have no default premium whatsoever because the government will not default on its debts. I mean, think about it this way. Look, the government owes you, sir, $1,000. Well, if the government doesn't have it, we can just print $1,000 to give you. Okay, the printing press isn't working. Okay, well, we'll just raise taxes. Okay, that's not politically feasible. Well, fine, we'll figure out some lies about some poor little country and invade it and take its money and assets. That's what we do. We will just pay you off. So there's no default premium on a treasury, as it were. Now, on other ones, let's try this. On a credit card, there would be a high default premium because a lot of people don't pay their credit card bills. A lot of people don't. And so that's one of the reasons that credit card rates are ridiculously high usually. Now let's try this one. How about a home loan? What say you? Would a home loan have a big or a small default premium? No, it would have a small because they'll take the house back. Okay? They if you don't pay your home loan payments, they'll just take the house back and sell it. And what if the market value is less than what's owed on the loan? You've been paying insurance all along, you didn't know, called magic. You paid the premiums, and that will make them whole on the difference between market value and loan balance. And most people have no idea that is there. They've paid all this money for insurance, and then the house is taken away from them by the bank, and the insurance the people they threw out paid is what makes the bank all fine again. Of course, the bank's still going to cry crocodile tears. Look how much we're losing on this. No, they aren't losing because you paid for it, and then they kicked your ass out of the house and left you homeless. Anyway, how about on a car loan? Would that be a high or a low default premium? What would you think, ma'am, on a car loan? Low. It is low, but it's not as low as a house. You see, because when you pull a car off the car lot, its value drops right away. So in other words, if they seize the car, yeah, they'll get some of their money back right there, but not all of it. Okay? So that one would be sort of low, but it's not as low. Now, student loan. That's guaranteed by the government. And of course, if you don't pay that, they will come after you. Oh, they will send black helicopters and send wet teams rappelling down into your house to shoot your cat. Okay, so those are relatively low default premiums. By the way, quick term. In finance parlance, 0.01% is called 1 basis point. So in other words, if I had 4.25%, went up to 4.60%, that would be a rise of 35 basis points. We use that term basis points. Just so you know, I almost used the term basis points before I had shown you and told you what it was. It just makes you sound more sophisticated when you talk like that. Okay, now the next one. This one's a little bit more difficult to put your thought around it. It's called the maturity premium. And even Treasury securities have the maturity premium. It has to do with time and volatility. The more time there is, the more things can happen. You, madam, ignoring me. No, that's quite okay. Now, what is going to happen when you walk out the door today of this classroom? Yes, you are absolutely, I mean, it's not absolutely certain, but you are pretty darn sure you're just going to go back to your place and Netflix and chill or whatever it is. Yep. By the way, I saw a movie. It is just excellent, kind of like a 60s, 50s type of film noir. It was called Voice of the Stone. Anyway, try to stay on topic. Okay, it was really good. Okay, now, the thing, though, is that now, what's going to happen to you over the next 30 years? Well, you have some ideas about what you'd like to, but, I mean, you could be the CEO of Megacorp International. Or you could be abducted by aliens and forced to, lead a rebellion to get back to Earth. Or you might become an avocado. I don't know, these GMOs. I've heard scary things. You don't know. I mean, ask Bruce Jenner 20 years ago, what will you be? I'll bet you he would not have even seen that one coming. No, no. I mean, someone tells me that, I'll beat that man. Well, no, that's probably what he does. No. God, why this class acts like this. Okay, now. Okay, so here's how the maturity premium works. Think about it this way. You, sir, decide to buy a home. You do? Yeah. Now, you're going to buy, did you know that the average buyer sells a home after 7 years? That's typical. Okay. So now here's what we're going to do. You're going to get a loan from me at 6%. Now, in about 5 years, mortgage interest rates have fallen to 3%. Do you know what you're going to do in that situation? What's that? You're going to refi. You're going to borrow, you're going to refinance a loan at the lower 3%. That's what people do. See, so I was expecting to get 6% from you on what I lent you for 30 years, and you go and screw me over because now I get that money back and I can lend it out at only 3%. So I've got a risk on the downside. And the longer the time goes on, the more likely interest rates are to go down and up. So the next thing is, remember that 7 years. Suppose that in 7 years, you're thinking of moving. But you find out that mortgage interest rates have gone to 12%. Are you going to move? No. Even though by this time you have 5 kids, you have your brother-in-law living in the basement, and then his buddies and him are running a grindcore grunge band out in the garage. And then there are people you don't even know down in the basement who are wearing masks and doing some kind of production. You're not going to move. You'll stack those mother. You're not going to do that. You're just stay in that house. 12%? No. Some of you are moving up to the attic. And a few of you moving into the chimney. No, wait, we can't do that because Uncle Bob went up there a few years ago and he got stuck. We still can't get him out. Okay. We feed him every day. I mean, he's not dead or anything. He smells pretty bad now, what with the soot and the fat. But okay. you see that no matter what happens, the more time there is, the more likely something adverse to the lender, either interest rates will go down and people will refi, or interest rates will go up and people won't move. So in other words, the maturity premium increases with the increasing time of the loan. Regardless of whether it's a good loan or a bad loan, a government loan, a corporate loan, whatever, R sub M is there, the risk of the maturity premium. And then there's this last one, R sub L. It's called the liquidity premium, or sometimes called the illiquidity premium. Now remember, I gave you the definition of liquidity, the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. The liquidity, the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Now, a lot of loans are highly liquid, and a lot of instruments. So, for example, if you have a treasury bill, you can sell it to someone else in a split second. Extreme high liquidity. I mean, if you have a listed stock, those are highly liquid. Corporate bonds are generally highly liquid. However, there are a lot of types of things. Okay, mortgage loans are actually quite liquid. Most banks, and people don't even have any idea this is going on, a bank doesn't have your loan for more than a couple of hours before it sells it to what's called a secondary mortgage market. They'll get in a bunch of loans on a day, then they'll package them all together, and they'll sell them. They made, let's say $500,000 in loans on houses. They sell those the next day. Well, I still make my payments at the bank. Yeah, all they're doing is they're the pass-through agent. They get a fee for processing loans that they don't even have anymore. That secondary mortgage market is trillions of dollars in size. They package hundreds and thousands of loans and turn them into a giant blob, and then they chop it up into different risk components, and they sell it to the most powerful, wealthy investors in the world, countries, trusts, corporations, families. The names of them are things like Ginnie Mae, Sally Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The secondary mortgage market is vast. And it's happening every day. And the money of the world, from the Chinese, Japanese, Canadians, Saudis, American companies, they participate in these markets by buying these products. And then there are others who write derivatives backed by these products. Those derivatives have names like CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations. I mean, it's a vast ocean. Hardly anyone outside of finance has any clue is out there like giant bubbles floating around our money space. But anyway, however, there are some kinds of things that are not easy. A bank gives out credit cards. It can't sell those unless they want to take a very big hit. Pennies on the dollar, they can unload those. Interestingly, car loans don't have a secondary market. In other words, a bank that makes car loans couldn't dump those very quickly to another bank unless the first bank is in trouble, and then the second bank will get them at pennies on the dollar. As a matter of fact, a great example are penny stocks. When I ran a penny stock house many, many years ago, and we dealt in stocks that were barely listed. They were stocks anywhere from $5 down to 1/16. Of a dollar. As I mentioned before, back in the day, we didn't quote in dollars and cents. We quoted in dollars and fractions. So we would have a stock that was selling at 3/16. That meant that it was selling at a really, really pathetic amount of money, about 37.5 cents a share. You know, it wasn't even that. One way or the other. Okay, but anyway, there was good example. There was this person had held a stock for a long time when the company was dead. And some of the players I knew had reverse merged a private company into it. So the stock was alive again. We got it running on the listings, but she wanted to unload 1,000 shares of it. She'd had them for years and years, back when the company was alive in its original form. And so, you know, I was a market maker. I posted 1,000 shares on the electronic bulletin board service, the OTC, the over-the-counter, 1,000 shares for sale. Nothing. Not one bite. Days passed. And I called a couple of other market makers. I said, don't you have anyone? Finally, we found someone who would pick up 300 shares, but there were still 700 sitting out there. The woman would call me every day, have you sold them? And it was like, I got 300 sold. Well, what about the other 700? Well, they're still sitting here waiting for someone to buy them. That's liquidity premium from hell. She was suffering massive opportunity cost of her money because she couldn't unload them. The same would be true. So, for example, if you, sir, you are a fine, upstanding young man from a great family. Wealth is part of your thing. And I mean, your reputation is sterling. I mean, it's just like you were never at a party with a guy named Brett Kavanaugh. Too soon? Okay. Well, you're here at ISU because your parents didn't want to pay a bribe to get you into Harvard. Again, too soon? Okay. Well, now, you come to this young woman, you need $100. And you get your lawyers to write up a nice parchment paper with wherefores and the parties there too, and what ifs and who farted and all that kind of stuff with a notary seal. And she charges you an interest rate of 5%. She's walking down the street one day in Chicago, downtown Chicago, and there's this old decrepit man sitting there, hunched over, and he looks at her, hey, I know you. I taught you in FIL 240, Section 5. My God, it's good to see. My God, you've gotten old. It's good to see. I need a loan. Can you hook me up with $100? Here, I'll write it. I got a piece of toilet paper I stole from that bathroom in Qdoba there in the financial district. I owe you $100. Here. Are you going to charge me the same interest rate you charged him? No. You see, because, I mean, if you needed that $100, you could sell his loan to someone else right away. Everyone knows he's a great guy and he's good for the money. Could you sell that piece of toilet paper that I've written on and get your $100 back? No. Liquidity premium. You're going to have to charge me more for the fact that you can't unload that money. There you go. So you see, this kind of gives you an idea of the structure of an interest rate. It's kind of complicated. Now I've got to switch gears and get you from this theoretical thing. Whoa, let me show you something real quick here, though. This, you can find this on certain news sites, certain financial news sites, and you can also find it, I'm pretty sure, in Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage. But sometimes we are very curious about what this default premium is running. Because if it is expanding, getting larger, that is a sign that the financial markets see more risk as time now than earlier. One thing that we can do is we could take, let's say, a 30-year Treasury bond. Let's say that thing is right now has a yield of 4.75%. Now let's look at a 30-year AAA corporate bond. Very high quality. Now you see the only difference in terms of this structure right here. They both have the same risk-free rate. There's only one risk-free rate. They would have the same maturity premium because they're the same length of time. They're both 30 years. And neither of them would be hard to sell. They have no liquidity premium to speak of. The only difference would be that the government debt would not have a default premium, but the corporate debt would. Even if it were very small, it would still have it. So what? Let's say that 30-year AAA is selling at 5.05%, the yield is right now. If we take the difference of these two, which is 0.30%, we would know what the markets are assessing as the default premium for high-grade corporate debt. We call this number, this is 30 basis points. We would say that the credit default risk premium is 30 basis points on AAA. And we could do it, we could compare the Treasury against the double A's, the single A's. We can actually get the path of different risk debt instruments. We can also watch this over time. We have been seeing it recently getting larger. The spread between the 30-year Treasury and the 30-year AAAs and everything else, it has been widening. In other words, there is more and more risk being assessed by the markets in corporate debt. Why? Because we are moving toward a recession, and that's when companies default. So it's not moving hard much at all for AAA. But man, when you get down to like single A, the B's and the C's, it is really beginning to get, we're seeing the basis points getting seriously large now. And that's another message behind the scenes that, yeah, we're headed for a recession. And we are not going to stop it just because the White House is having a pissing fit or because the Fed saves the day. And it's not going to get better because the liberals are saying free education and free welfare for everyone. We're going to get hit by a train that will run over all the wishes and promises out there. Now, what I'm going to show you is not difficult math, but it's easy to make a mistake when you key it into a calculator. And there's another thing, too, in here. Before I show you, and it's actually the formula is easy, but like I said, I mean, I guarantee you, I've made mistakes so many times, I've disgraced myself missing a parenthesis doing this. But on we trod and all that. Here's the thing. The first thing you need to know is how to find the number of days between two dates. Okay, right off the top of your head, sir, how many days are there between September 24th, 2012, and November the 13th, 2018. How many days? Chop, chop. What is it? Really? Did you know that or did you just guess? Oh, you had me worried there for a second. Will you shut him up? Okay. Actually, there's a way that you can do it. Do not start September 25th, 26th, 20th. No. There are places online, days between calculators. You can type it into Google and say how many days between two dates. There is also a calculator on your computer that does it. Believe it or not, watch this. When you click on that stupid little calculator, it has amazing things. I did this morning, so it's already on the date calculator. If you start on the scientific calculator, which you should always have up, you can change it over to date calculation, and it will find the days between two dates. So let me put this into practice, because you need to know the number of days between two dates. This is a generalized formula that can be that's sort of like the one you would use for about anything that you would want to do in this regard. You invest $200 on September 24th, 2019. On November 13th, 2024, you sell the investment for $284. What was your annualized yield on this investment? This formula relies on knowing the exact number of years of the investment. So what you would need is the number of days divided by 365. Well, let me show you the formula. This is the annualized yield formula. It's actually very simple. There's a little more complicated way I show, but I don't think I'll do this with you. Just take the ending amount over the beginning amount. You got to trap that in parentheses for the calculator. And now you're going to take that to the 1 over the number of years, minus 1. And then times it by 100 to get a percent. Now, here's where you can get into some trouble. Now, the first thing I'm going to need to do is get the number of days. Now, the number of days, what was that, September 24th, 2019? Okay, so now, then you'll take it to the end. And again, Google has these calculators too. And if this is on a test or a quiz, I'll give you the number of days, okay? Just otherwise, but okay, now, we're going to need to go clear out to 2024, and that's why this calculator is kind of a pain in the butt to do. 2024, November, what was that? November what? 13th. November 13th. It's 1,877 days. The problem is, so the number of years, 1,877 days. is 1,877 divided by 365 years. That's the number you need right there. However, don't calculate it and then put in the result. You will get rounding error, and when you take an exponent of a rounding error, it just blows up on you. Here's how we do it. I'm going to do, on the calculator, 284 divided by 200 and raise that to the 1 over 1,877 divided by 365. If you do this right, and here's the key, is getting this into your calculator correctly. Please, for heaven's sakes, write down the numbers, the keystrokes. Let me exit. I'm going to pull up the TI-84, the 83 emulator, so you can see this. Watch. Clear it now. I'm going to open parenthesis. 284 divided by 200, close the parenthesis, raise this to the open, now you're going to do two. First thing I'm doing is trapping the whole exponent. And then I'm going to go 1 over, and then I'm going to open parentheses to trap that calculation in the denominator. 1877 divided by 365. Trap the denominator, trap the exponent. Now, I mentioned this before, an old trick some of you probably already know. If you do a parenthesis count, up is plus 1, down is minus 1, you should end up at 0. Watch what I mean. 1, 0. 1, 2, 1, 0. That's how I know. I'm not sure I've got it. I could have put a parenthesis in the wrong place, but I know I've got the right number of parentheses. And I can see there and there, I trapped the denominator. So now I just do the minus 1. Don't forget the minus 1. Enter. And then I can times that by 100 to get a percent. So in other words, 7.06%. That was your annualized yield on the investment. This allows you to be able to compare investments that you held for different periods of time so that it's apples to apples. Just again, watch it with that. Now I'm going to show you one that will surprise you. You have someone here. Okay. You, madam, you've fallen on hard times. You lost your job. You lost your dog. You lost your house. You're getting back on your feet with a little help from Jack Daniels and some THC in your vape mods. And you have gotten a job. But, I mean, you need money now. You got to have a place to live. So you come to me. I'm a payday loan type of person. You write me a check, and I won't cash it for 2 weeks until your paycheck comes in. But I'll give you the money now. You will? Yes, I will, because I care. Well, can I write a check for $500? Well, we can lend you $500. Sure. Just 2 weeks, you have to pay us. You write us a check, and then we cash that, but we don't cash it. You just postdate it for 2 weeks. This is wonderful. Okay, I'll tell you what. Okay, what we're going to do, $500, we're going to charge you 6% interest. So in other words, you're going to owe us $30. Okay, I'll write my check. for $530. Well, I'm sorry, I forgot. You got to also, you got an application fee here. We got to run, you know, the electronics, make sure you're not a criminal. And that's $20, $25. And of course, you're probably going to need us to cash the check because no place else is going to cash our checks. So that's a check cashing fee. That's only $10. And you can just write a check for, geez, 60. So do you just write us a check for $565? And you walk out of here with $500. And you can go to the store and buy food, give yourself a place to crash. It's all good. We're here to help. Well, you see, the problem is that you took my class and you know that you're borrowing $565, the ending value, over the beginning value to the 1 over 2 of 52 weeks or 14 of 365. You could do it either way. Minus 1. Oh, and let's not forget to multiply by 100% at the end. Let's see what your annualized APR on this loan is. Open parenthesis. 565 divided by 500. Close the parenthesis. Raise it to the open parenthesis to trap the whole exponent. 1 over, now open parenthesis again to do 2 over 52. Or you could do 14 days over 365. Really doesn't matter. We'll just do 2 divided by 52. Close the denominator, parenthesis. Close the exponent, parenthesis. Minus 1. Oh, God, that's an awful lot. Oh, no, it's worse because I still haven't multiplied by 100 to get a percentage. That loan has an APR of 2,299%. That loan has an APR. That's actually illegal, even under today's laws. But our Supreme Court many years ago said no, because those fees don't count as interest. Because the Supreme Court was too stupid to understand that. So this is what you're seeing on these predatory quickie loan places. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.